Chapter 89. Interlopers, now do those two gentlemen not very neat about the cuffs and buttons who attended the last coroner's inquest at the Soul's Arms reappear in the precincts with surprising swiftness, being, in fact, breathlessly fetched by the active and intelligent Beetle, and institute perquisitions through the court, and dive into the Soul's parlor, and write with ravenous little pens on tissue paper. Now do they note down, in the watches of the night, how the neighborhood of Chancery Lane was yesterday, at about midnight, thrown into a state of the most intense agitation and excitement by the following alarming and horrible discovery. Now do they set forth, how it will doubtless be remembered, that some time back a painful sensation was created in the public mind by a case of mysterious death from opium occurring in the first floor of the house occupied as a rag, bottle, and general marine store shop, by an eccentric individual of intemperate habits, far advanced in life, named Crook, and how, by a remarkable coincidence, Crook was examined at the inquest, which it may be recollected was held on that occasion at the Soul's Arms, a well-conducted tavern immediately adjoining the premises in question on the west side, and licensed to a highly respectable landlord, Mr. James George Boxby. Now do they show in as many words as possible how during some hours of yesterday evening a very peculiar smell was observed by the inhabitants of the court, in which the tragical occurrence which forms the subject of that present account transpired, and which odor was at one time so powerful that Mr. Swills, a comic vocalist professionally engaged by Mr. J.G. Boxby, has himself stated to our reporter that he mentioned to Miss M. Mulvillison, a lady of some pretensions to musical ability, likewise engaged by Mr. J.G. Boxby, to sing at a series of concerts called harmonic assemblies, or meetings, which it would appear, are held at the Soul's Arms under Mr. Boxby's direction pursuant to the act of George II. That he, Mr. Swills, found his voice seriously affected by the impure state of the atmosphere, his jocose expression at the time being, that he was like an empty post office, for he hadn't a single note in him. How this account of Mr. Swills is entirely corroborated by two intelligent married females residing in the same court, and known respectively by the names of Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins, both of whom observed the fetid effluvia, and regarded them as being emitted from the premises, in the occupation of Crook, the unfortunate deceased. All this and a great deal more the two gentlemen who have formed an amicable partnership in the melancholy catastrophe right down on the spot, and the boy population of the court out of bed in a moment, swarm up the shutters of the Soul's Arms parlor, to behold the tops of their heads, while they are about it. The whole court, adult as well as boy, is sleepless for that night, and can do nothing but wrap up its many heads, and talk of the ill-fated house, and look at it. Miss Flight has been bravely rescued from her chamber, as if it were in flames, and accommodated with a bed at the Soul's Arms. The Soul neither turns off its gas, nor shuts its door all night, for any kind of public excitement makes good for the Soul and causes the court to stand in need of comfort. The house has not done so much in the stomachic article of cloves or in brandy and water warm since the inquest. The moment the potboy heard what had happened, he rolled up his shirt sleeves tight to his shoulders and said, "There'll be a run upon us." In the first outcry, young Piper dashed off for the fire engines, and returned in triumph at a jolting gallop, perched up aloft on the phoenix and holding on to that fabulous creature with all his might in the midst of helmets and torches. One helmet remains behind after careful investigation of all chinks and crannies, and slowly paces up and down before the house in company with one of the two policemen who have likewise been left in charge thereof. To this trio, everybody in the court possessed of sixpence has an insatiate desire to exhibit hospitality in a liquid form. Mr. Weevil and his friend Mr. Guppy are within the bar at the Soul, and are worth anything to the Soul that the bar contains, if they will only stay there. This is not a time, says Mr. Bogsby, to haggle about money, though he looks something sharply after it. Over the counter. Give your orders, you two gentlemen, and you're welcome to whatever you put a name to. Thus entreated, the two gentlemen, Mr. Weevil especially, put names to so many things, that in course of time they find it difficult to put a name to anything quite distinctly, though they still relate to all newcomers some version of the night they have had of it, and of what they said, and what they thought, and what they saw. Meanwhile, one or other of the policemen often flits about the door, and pushing it open a little way at the full length of his arm, looks in from outer gloom. Not that he has any suspicions, but that he may as well know what they are up to in there. Thus night pursues its leaden course, finding the court still out of bed through the unwonted hours, still treating and being treated, still conducting itself similarly to a court that has had a little money left it unexpectedly. Thus night at length with slow retreating steps departs, and the lamplighter going his rounds, like an executioner to a despotic king, strikes off the little heads of fire that have aspired to lessen the darkness. Thus the day cometh, whether or no. And the day may discern, even with its dim London eye, that the court has been up all night. Over and above the faces, that have fallen drowsily on tables and the heels, that lie prone on hard floors instead of beds, the brick and mortar physiognomy of the very court itself looks worn and jaded. And now the neighborhood, waking up and beginning to hear of what has happened, comes streaming in, half-dressed, to ask questions, and the two policemen and the helmet who are far less impressible externally than the court, have enough to do to keep the door. Good gracious, gentlemen, says Mr. Snagsby, coming up. What's this I hear? Why, it's true, returns one of the policemen. That's what it is. Now move on here, come. Why, good gracious, gentlemen, says Mr. Snagsby, somewhat promptly backed away, I was at this door last night betwixt 10 and 11 o'clock in conversation with the young man who lodges here. Indeed? Returns the policeman. You will find the young man next door then. Now move on here, some of you. Not hurt, I hope? Says Mr. Snagsby. Hurt? No. What's to hurt him? Mr. Snagsby, wholly unable to answer this or any question in his troubled mind, repairs to the soul's arms and finds Mr. Weevil languishing over tea and toast with a considerable expression on him of exhausted excitement and exhausted tobacco smoke. And Mr. Guppy likewise. Quoth Mr. Snagsby, dear, 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 what a fate there seems in all this. And my lit, Mr. Snagsby's power of speech deserts him in the formation of the words, my little woman. For to see that injured female walk into the soul's arms at that hour of the morning and stand before the beer engine, with her eyes fixed upon him like an accusing spirit, strikes him dumb. My dear, says Mr. Snagsby when his tongue is loosened, will you take anything? A little nut to put to fine a point upon the drop of shrub? No, says Mrs. Snagsby. My love, you know these two gentlemen? Yes, says Mrs. Snagsby, and in a rigid manner acknowledges their presence, still fixing Mr. Snagsby with her eye. The devoted Mr. Snagsby cannot bear this treatment. He takes Mrs. Snagsby by the hand, and leads her aside to an adjacent cask. My little woman, why do you look at me in that way? Pray don't do it. I can't help my looks, says Mrs. Snagsby, and if I could I wouldn't. Mr. Snagsby, with his cough of meekness, rejoins, wouldn't you really, my dear? And meditates. Then coughs his cough of trouble and says, this is a dreadful mystery, my love. Still fearfully disconcerted by Mrs. Snagsby's eye. It is, returns Mrs. Snagsby, shaking her head, a dreadful mystery. My little woman, urges Mr. Snagsby in a piteous manner, don't for goodness' sake speak to me with that bitter expression and look at me in that searching way. I beg and entreat of you not to do it. Good Lord, you don't suppose that I would go spontaneously combusting any person, my dear? I can't say, returns Mrs. Snagsby. On a hasty review of his unfortunate position, Mr. Snagsby can't say either. He is not prepared positively to deny that he may have had something to do with it. He has had something he don't know what to do with, so much in this connection, that is mysterious, that it is possible he may even be implicated, without knowing it, in the present transaction. He faintly wipes his forehead with his handkerchief and gasps. My life, says the unhappy stationer, would you have any objections to mention why, being in general so delicately circumspect in your conduct, you come into a wine vaults before breakfast? Why do you come here? Inquires Mrs. Snagsby. My dear, merely to know the rights of the fatal accident which has happened to the venerable party who has been combusted. Mr. Snagsby has made a pause to suppress a groan. I should then have related them to you, my love, over your French roll. I dare say you would. You relate everything to me, Mr. Snagsby. Every my lit, I should be glad, says Mrs. Snagsby, after contemplating his increased confusion with a severe and sinister smile, if you would come home with me. I think you may be safer there, Mr. Snagsby, than anywhere else. My love, I don't know, but what I may be, I am sure. I am ready to go. Mr. Snagsby casts his eye forlornly round the bar, gives Messrs. Weevil and Guppy good morning, assures them of the satisfaction with which he sees them uninjured, and accompanies Mrs. Snagsby from the soul's arms. Before night is out, whether he may not be responsible for some inconceivable part in the catastrophe which is the talk of the whole neighborhood is almost resolved into certainty by Mrs. Snagsby's pertinacity in that fixed gaze. His mental sufferings are so great that he entertains wandering ideas of delivering himself up to justice and requiring to be cleared, if innocent, and punished with the utmost rigor of the law if guilty. Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy, having taken their breakfast, step into Lincoln's Inn, to take a little walk about the square, and clear as many of the dark cobwebs out of their brains as a little walk may. There can be no more favorable time than the present, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, after they have broodingly made out the four sides of the square, for a word or two between us upon a point on which we must, with very little delay, come to an understanding. Now, I tell you what, William G. Exclamation point returns the other, eyeing his companion with a bloodshot eye. If it's a point of conspiracy, you needn't take the trouble to mention it. I have had enough of that, and I ain't going to have any more. We shall have you taking fire next, or blowing up with a bang. This supposititious phenomenon is so very disagreeable to Mr. Guppy that his voice quakes as he says in a moral way, Tony, I should have thought that what we went through last night would have been a lesson to you never to be personal anymore, as long as you lived. To which Mr. Weevil returns, William, I should have thought it would have been a lesson to you never to conspire anymore, as long as you lived. To which Mr. Guppy says, who's conspiring? To which Mr. Jobling replies, why, you are. To which Mr. Guppy retorts, no, I am not. To which Mr. Jobling retorts again, yes, you are. To which Mr. Guppy retorts, who says so? To which Mr. Jobling retorts, I say so. To which Mr. Guppy retorts, oh, indeed. To which Mr. Jobling retorts, yes, indeed. And both being now in a heated state, they walk on silently for a while to cool down again. Tony, says Mr. Guppy then, if you heard your friend out instead of flying at him, you wouldn't fall into mistakes. But your temper is hasty, and you are not considerate. Possessing in yourself, Tony, all that is calculated to charm the eye, oh, blow the eye, cries Mr. Weevil, cutting him short. Say what you have got to say. Finding his friend in this morose and material condition, Mr. Guppy only expresses the finer feelings of his soul through the tone of injury in which he recommences. Tony, when I say there is a point on which we must come to an understanding pretty soon, I say so quite apart from any kind of conspiring, however innocent. You know it is professionally arranged beforehand in all cases that are tried what facts the witnesses are to prove. Is it or is it not desirable that we should know what facts we are to prove on the inquiry into the death of this unfortunate old Mo gentleman?
Mr. Guppy was going to say mogul, but thinks gentleman better suited to the circumstances.
What facts? The facts. The facts bearing on that inquiry. Those are Mr. Guppy tells them off on his fingers, what we knew of his habits, when you saw him last, what his condition was then, the discovery that we made, and how we made it.
Yes, says Mr. Weevil. Those are about the facts.
We made the discovery in consequence of his having, in his eccentric way, an appointment with you at 12 o'clock at night, when you were to explain some writing to him as you had often done before on account of his not being able to read.
I, spending the evening with you, was called down and so forth.
The inquiry being only into the circumstances touching the death of the deceased, it's not necessary to go beyond these facts. I suppose you'll agree?
No, returns Mr. Weevil. I suppose not.
And this is not a conspiracy, perhaps?
Says the injured Guppy.
No, returns his friend. If it's nothing worse than this, I withdraw the observation.
Now, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, taking his arm again, and walking him slowly on, I should like to know, in a friendly way, whether you have yet thought over the many advantages of your continuing to live at that place?
What do you mean?
Says Tony, stopping.
Whether you have yet thought over the many advantages of your
Gutenberg edition.
End of chapter.